Sacred and Profane Dances with that very distinctive ending. And in that performance, we heard Yolanda Condonassis, and the group was called Oberlin 21. The conductor, Bridget Michaela Reichel, leading Oberlin 21. Hope you enjoyed that. I'm Lynn Warfel.
Beautiful classical programming. That's what you're listening to right here on WHFR Dearborn. Good day. I'm Susan McGraw. Thank you for being a part of this lovely classical programming. I am so proud to be the person that gets to work with so many great programs and so many wonderful people here as WHFR General Manager. And it is my pleasure to invite you to be a part of our free bi-monthly publication called the WHFR Loyal Listener. If you'd like to be put on the mailing list for the WHFR Loyal Listener, all you have to do is give me a call. It's as simple as that. Call this number, 313-845-9842. Again, 313-845-9842. The Loyal Listener is a publication that comes out with programming schedule changes, events that we're participating in the community, and so much more. We'd love to have you join us as a Loyal Listener, and thank you for being a listener at that. Enjoy your day.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, good morning, listeners. Today our program is going to be about a subject that might be a little confusing, and our guest today, hopefully it won't be confusing, is Dr. Dennis R. Papazian. But Dennis, we'd like to welcome you to our program.
Thanks, Ned. It's good to be here.
And I'm sure the people are going to learn a lot. Our subject matter today is about the First World War and its aftermath. As you know, this program is devoted to how current events are affected by the events in recent history and sometimes far history. And the problems that we live today are usually a result, in this case, of the unresolved issues of World War I. So today's program is going to be devoted into four sections about something about the World War I, and mostly about its ending, not why it got started. And when it did conclude, most of us know there was a peace treaty, or less if we don't know much about it, of the Peace Treaty of Versailles. The Peace Treaty of Versailles was a peace treaty concluding the war with the Allies, which in this case would have been the United States, France, England, and Italy, against the Germans, in other words, with the Germans and the Austrians. However, there were other peace treaties, and those peace treaties were two others. And the first one Dennis would probably talk about. Versailles is the former palace of the French kings in France, and that's why the peace treaty, because it was conducted there, is called the Peace Treaty of Versailles. And as I mentioned before, this peace treaty has to do only with the Allies, the Western Allies, and Germany in the Austrian Empire. However, the Ottoman Empire, which today is the Turkish Republic, what's left of it, had a peace treaty with the Western Allies, and that peace treaty initially was the Peace Treaty of Sèvres, which is another district in France, in Paris. That peace treaty was written, but however, it never was fully consummated, and a future peace treaty called the Peace Treaty of Lausanne, which transpired in the early 1920s, 22, 23, I believe. Dennis will help us with that.
1923.
There you go. I guessed pretty good. Thank you, Dennis.
You're good, Ned.
Anyway, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about these two peace treaties, but they bring a little something in that most people don't know. The United States of America never declared war against the Ottoman Empire, so the United States was not part of the Peace Treaty of Sèvres or the Peace Treaty of Lausanne. Those of you who have seen the picture Lawrence of Arabia might make some sense to you if you know the stories of how the English and the French divided up the Ottoman Empire pretty much among them. So these two peace treaties are not as well known, and the legality of the first one, Sèvres, was changed primarily because of the Russian Revolution and the establishment of the Bolshevik regime in the former Tsarist Russia. So today's program, in order to make this all understandable, we'll talk about the end of the First World War. That will be a part, and then we'll talk about another part, the Peace Treaty of Sèvres, and then the Peace Treaty of Lausanne, and finally how these peace treaties affected issues between the various minorities. You must remember the minorities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire were many, Serbs, Croats, on and on, as now we're living the problems of those people not being happy with one another. The same is true with the Peace Treaty of Lausanne, which guaranteed certain rights of the minorities of the Turkish Empire. The last part of the program will be devoted to some of these current issues that are come out of these unresolved issues of the First World War. And Dennis is going to try to make some sense of all this. All I did is pose the problem.
I think you've done a great job, Ned.
Thank you. Now we're going to take a little bit of time to, unfortunately, I had to shorten his resume, so now you can understand how important Dennis is in this whole matter. And I'm going to read you a part of Dr. Papazian's brief resume, and it goes as follows. Dr. Dennis R. Papazian is Emeritus Professor of History and Founding Director of the Armenian Research Center at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. Dr. Papazian was broadly educated at Wayne State University with a B.A. in History and Philosophy, an M.A. in East European Studies, the Ohio State University, Columbus, Ohio, where he attended special programs on Middle East, Harvard University, Cambridge, where he studied Soviet influence on international student organizations, and the School of International Studies, Putnam in Vermont, where he studied Russian and Polish. Moscow University, USSR, where he was a graduate exchange student in the first wave of student exchanges between the USA and the USSR. Finally, he attended the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, where he earned a MA and a PhD in history. Now I have to stop to take a breath, Dr. Papazian.
I've lived a long time.
You've lived a long time. But we want to make sure when the people are listening to you, they can appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you.
Dennis speaks fluent Russian. Dr. Papazian began his teaching career right here at the newly opened campus, the University of Michigan in Dearborn. And after many academic positions, which I will not recite, he ended up, Dr. Papazian, was appointed Associate Provost of Academic Affairs and Office in Charge of Liberal Arts, Business Administration, and Engineering. Quite an achievement. Now, he was also a member of the Executive Board of the Horace H. Rackham School of Graduate Studies in Ann Arbor, which supervises most graduate programs of the Tri-Campus University of Michigan system. He was Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. His present position is that of Associate Provost of Academic Affairs, covering the College of Arts, Sciences, Letters.
Actually, I'm retired now.
Yes, I was going to clarify that. You are now retired in New Jersey. However, to go off record, you are doing something in New Jersey, which we will you could add right now extemporaneously.
Teaching. I'm doing quite a bit in New Jersey. My wife is now a provost at Lehman College, part of City University.
And you?
I am what I call a public intellectual.
There you go. Okay. Now, aside from that, he was chairman, College of Literature, Science, and Arts, UMD, chairman of the Department of Social Services, chairman of the Section of Social and Behavior Sciences, now divided into the Department of Social Sciences. Well, as you can see, the most important thing as it relates to us here this evening is Dr. Papazian has lectured all over the world, including Armenia, Germany, the Czech Republic, Israel, Russia, and many cities throughout the United States. He has been interviewed scores of times on radio, TV, and newspapers, especially on international relations and the Armenian genocide, and when issues concern Russia, because he's a Russian specialist. He has read academic papers, participated in many panel discussions and academic conferences throughout the world, which I will not identify. As you can see, and this I had to chop up his very nice resume in order to get it in within a reasonable time period. Well, Dr. Papazian, as we mentioned, I'm leaving it up to you to have a brief discussion on the end of the First World War. The war ended without getting into the issues of it, and eventually we had to have a peace treaty, and you can identify all the elements in the war so that we can get to briefly indicate they were resolved by the Versailles Treaty. Who were the people that were involved in here, the various minorities when the war ended?
Well, as you said earlier, Ned, they really weren't resolved, and I think we can make a good argument that World War II was nothing but a continuation of World War I. One led directly to the other. The first genocide of the 20th century occurred during World War I, and the second major genocide of the 20th century occurred during World War II. So we have a big pattern there. What happened, of course, is that all of Europe went to war, and it was a real bloody mess. It was a stupid thing to get into, and nothing really was resolved. In November of 1918, there was an armistice. That meant they quit fighting. Then they had to write a peace treaty, and that took a great deal of time. It wasn't done until 28th of June 1919. That's several months later, and as you mentioned, it was done at Versailles in the Hall of Mirrors. the former palace of the French kings, a beautiful, beautiful and expensive place. So the Versailles Treaty dealt with Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as you mentioned. But more of interest to us is the fact that the Ottoman Empire, though technically defeated in August 10th, 1920, we had the Treaty of Versailles. Now, the end of the war with the Ottoman Empire was at Mudros, the armistice of Mudros in October of 1918. Now, we don't have Sèvres until August of 1920.
Yeah.
So a lot of time has passed.
Yeah. Dennis, could you explain to the people who were the basic minorities that the peace treaty of Versailles tried to solve
their
problem?
Well, you have the Hungarians, you have the Czechs, you have the Slovaks, you have the
Slovenes.
Slovenes, Serbs, what else?
There's Croats.
Croats, right. Mm-hmm. We can't forget them. And
then the creation of Yugoslavia, all these various people that were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
They became independent states, as did Greece, of course, much earlier. And so what we have is a checkerboard of small countries in Europe. And, of course, the worst part of it was that the border between Germany and France and the relationship between Germany and France was not settled properly, and so it left the feeling of revenge amongst the Germans, and, of course, eventually this led to the rise of Hitler and into World War II. So World War II was nothing but a continuation of World War I. So the Treaty of Versailles tried to bring harmony and peace and did to some small extent, but the major issues were not solved.
So the minority issues in Europe were not solved, but the...
Well, they weren't solved, and more importantly, the issue of German repatriation towards the Allies, particularly France, was not solved. And as you know, the Germans had to pay the French off. The French occupied the Rhine Valley, the industrial heartland of Germany, until these things were paid. The amount was humongous. And so what happened, it led to rapid inflation in Germany, and it led eventually to a collapse of German industry, to unemployment, and then the rise of National Socialism, which brought people back together under a dictatorial kind of government.
Great. That brings us to a stopping point. We're at the quarter point of the program, and we need to identify ourselves. I am Ned Apigian. I'm the host of this program called Then and Now, which is how history affects current events. And that's what we're discussing, the issues of the unresolved issues of the peace treaties of World War I, the one you know more about, which we just talked about, is Versailles. You are listening to WHFR-FM at 89.3 FM, and we are broadcasting from the Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan, and this is a pre-recorded program. You cannot call in. However, you can listen to us on the Internet by dialing WHFR.FM, and this program will be broadcast on Saturday, March 27th, and that's the date you need to know if you want to hear it again. And you just click on that, and you would get this program of Then and Now under this section called Forum. Now, what we want to talk about, as I explained, the Peace Treaty of Versailles didn't solve all the problems of the European minorities, but the Peace Treaty of Sèvres, let's get into that a little bit, because what did that try to do with the Ottoman Empire, even though the time went by? Who were the people it was trying to affect in issues?
Well, you've got a whole bunch of people with the Ottoman Empire. You have the Armenians, you have a few Greeks, you have minority Jews, you have the Arabs of what is now Syria and Lebanon, Palestine, the Hejaz, what is now Saudi Arabia, Yemen.
The Kurds, of course,
The Kurds are still there. They didn't have an independent state. But
they were part of the treaty, as I remember.
They were an important element. So the Treaty of Sèvres tried to, in effect, disjoint the Ottoman Empire. It gave territory to Great Britain, it gave territory to France, it gave a little territory to Greece, it gave a little territory to, the rest was sort of mixed. It was chiefly France, Great Britain, Russia was out of the picture by this time. And so we have this humongous empire now divided up. But the problem was the Turks never really lost the war. They surrendered at Mudros in October of 1918.
Isn't that the
same
thing?
But they had standing armies at vital points within Anatolia, the Turkish heartland, what is today Turkey. They perceived this as a heartland. Traditionally, it was ancient Armenia. So now what happened was the British, on behalf of the Allies, occupy Constantinople, which today we call Istanbul, and they forced the Sultan to leave and brought in a democratic elected government. Now, the head of the government changed rapidly, but Damat Ferid Pasha was a very active prime minister who came and went, came and went, came and went. This government now established a war crimes trial, a courts-martial, to try those who were involved in the Armenian genocide. And this trial went on for a good length of time. It finally fell apart, but not after evidence was gathered and many, many sentences were applied to guilty parties. In other words, all of the people weren't tried, but a whole bunch of them were. A book has just appeared this month. Unfortunately, it's in Turkey, which is the record of that war crimes trial, which has all of the indictment, the evidence, the testimony, the whole works. It's a several hundred page volume produced by Taner Akçam, a Turkish scholar, and Vahakan Dadrin, an Armenian scholar. As I say, it's just come out this month, and it is a world shaker.
Earlier,
anyway, we had parts of this this trial record.
But the Turkish trial of the post government is one issue, but that's not part of the peace treaty of Sèvres designated certain things to be done.
Right. Now, what
partition, including other people, other than this Armenian issue.
What I'm getting at is that the Turkish state was not completely occupied. Only Istanbul was occupied. The trials were held, but they fell apart because of a national renaissance in Anatolia led by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and his cohorts, including Kazım Karabekir on the Armenian front. So we have a situation where the Turks don't have to sign the Treaty of Sèvres, which divided up Turkey, which produced a Armenia. The war by Woodrow Wilson defined the borders of Armenia. And so the Turks refused to sign it, and it became a nothing treaty.
But the peace treaty of Sèvres is not only about Armenia.
No. But
that's what I would like you to delve into
the
other peoples. For example, Iraq was governed by the Turks with three distinct provinces, which the English, when they took it over, combined it, and hence we have the problems of Iraq today because of the joining of the three separate parts. One was Baghdad, Basra, and the first one at the top was, I forget the name of it now. So we'll later get into the results of this, but
okay, but now
the other peoples were affected.
I'm going to argue with you. I'm going to say, had they divided all of these people and given them independence, these segments of states today, it would be worse than what happened in Europe, which you complained about, with all those minorities giving independent states and yet having quarrels amongst themselves. My contention is that the same thing would have happened whether the British sliced it this way or that way or the French sliced it this way or that way. The fact of the matter is the Middle East is a melting pot of many peoples, and the only way to have peace in the Middle East is for people to accept one another at face value, to have multinational states, and for people to learn to get along with one another.
I'm sure that's true. What I wanted to get to is that the peace treaty of Sèvres had other peoples problems tried to be resolved. Now, whether the Turks signed the Treaty of Sèvres or not, I wasn't sure, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, well, what happened was this. The
there were other people involved.
Controlled the non-Turkish territory of the Ottoman Empire. So Syria and Iraq and all those things were put together as mandates of the people who signed Versailles. In other words, they weren't independent states. There were states on the way to independence, and they were controlled by the Allied powers, the French, the British, to some extent the Greeks, et cetera, et cetera. So the situation was not one of independent states, but of quasi-semi-independent states. So that settled the periphery. The question is, what about the heartland, where most of the Turks lived? Not Arabs, not Jews, not Iraqis or Saudis, but Turks themselves. They did not surrender their arms. The Allies were confronted with what the Turks call a national liberation movement led by Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. Mm-hmm. He cleared Anatolia of Greeks and French and any other foreign armies. So he has realistic control. Now the Allies, who had been sitting in Constantinople or Istanbul, have to face a new reality, what you would call a de facto government rather than a de jure government. In other words, a real government but not a legal government. So now they have to work with these people in Anatolia. Mustafa Kemal sends one of his closest allies, Ismet Pasha, Nurnu, later the name, last name was added. They met in Lausanne, and the Turks said, we don't want any Armenia, we don't want any this, we don't want any that, and we will sign a peace treaty, but it's not going to have what you had in the peace treaty of Sèvres. And because the Turks were in a strong position, the British had to decide either to fight Mustafa Kemal or to give in to this new treaty, effectively dictated by the Turks. Now, the British were tired. The world was tired. No one wanted to continue fighting in 1920. So the British sort of waved the flag, tooted the horns, and walked out. So what does the Treaty of Lausanne do? It's a very important treaty because it is the establishment treaty of present-day Turkey.
Yeah,
Turkey was made legal by the Treaty of Lausanne.
Right. Before we get into that, because we have a few more minutes before we get into the peace treaty of Lausanne, one of the things I wanted to add, hopefully you to comment on, well, the Allies occupied Turkey after the First World War.
Occupied Istanbul.
Well, as I remember looking at the map, the Greeks and the Italians all occupied parts.
They invaded, but never really took total control. You're right,
yeah,
they invade.
What is referred to as the Greek War is they were the Allied occupants of the conquered country. And it referring as if other people, the English and the French, left their sections, let the Turkish national movement develop. But the Greeks ended up as Allied occupiers of the country, and they got eventually pushed out.
What is
the Treaty of Sèvres? Is it before the involvement of them leaving, or is it during the involvement of this?
It's approximately the same time. In other words,
that's what I wanted to clarify.
After Versailles, the Allies moved in to take their hunks of territory. Now, when they took the Arab states, there wasn't much to do because the Sheriff of Mecca, Sheriff Hussein, and his sons cooperated with the British, and the British and the French made them kings of these various little Arab kingdoms. So that went off pretty well, pretty smoothly. Now, the big issue is what's going to happen.
They took Abdullah and made him king of Jordan. They created Jordan. They took Prince Faisal, made him king of Iraq.
Right, right. So that went relatively peaceable, okay? The question is Anatolia, what is today Turkey? Now, the Allies did not occupy it. They sent in troops to try and occupy it.
Mm-hmm.
The French came up from Syria and drove north. The Greeks were landed around Smyrna and drove inland. The Italians took the Dodecanese, which they had taken on and off anyhow. And so what we see is the attempt by certain of the Allied powers to occupy Turkey. It was not occupied. But because they had armies there, these Turkish armies drove out the French, the Greeks, and the Italians. And the Turks call that the Turkish War of Independence. We just call it a war.
My clarification was that these people were legitimate occupiers of the Allies of the First World War. That's the only point I wanted to make.
No, they weren't. They were.
The Italians and the Greeks fought on the First World War on the Allied side, did they not?
Yes, but they were invading under Sèvres, which never was signed by the Turks.
Why do you refer to it as invading under Sèvres?
Because the Turks did not sign a peace treaty allowing them to take that territory.
Okay, now so who did recognize the peace treaty of Sèvres? Anybody?
I know.
Nobody. No one did.
No.
Okay. So as I understand it, when we get into the peace treaty of Lausanne, which I'm looking at my clock and partitioning the program, hopefully we'll get into it.
It's a very important treaty.
It's a very important treaty for the establishment of modern-day Turkey.
More so.
Because it gave certain rights to the minorities. But the whole Kurdish question, is mentioned in the peace treaty of Sèvres as well as in Lausanne. Thank you for that correction. What is the Kurdish section of the peace treaty of Sèvres that was ignored in peace treaty of Sèvres?
Everything in the peace treaty of Sèvres was ignored.
Everything. The whole thing was thrown out.
Yes. Okay. The Treaty of Versailles had already settled part of the empire. You see, the peace treaty of Sèvres was dealing with the heartland, Anatolia, today's Turkey.
I see.
Yeah. Okay. As we said, the Allies sent armies in to disarm the Turks in Anatolia so they can enforce a peace treaty of Sèvres.
But they didn't.
They did not succeed.
Right.
The Turks drove them out. The Turks then agreed to have a peace treaty because they had to have one. You can't live without them. Peace treaty, and they met at Lausanne with the Allies and effectively dictated the peace treaty. So the Kurds are not mentioned by names.
But what
the Armenians are not mentioned by names.
But what were the Kurds mentioned in the Sèvres Treaty? That's what I'm asking.
I don't remember the exact details, but they were dealt with.
Were they guaranteed a Kurdistan? That was my point, I guess.
You got me, Eddie. I don't know.
I see. So all the issues in the peace treaty of Sèvres, which were outside of what the main combatants, the British and the French, who divided up most of the Ottoman Empire, at least the Arabic lands among themselves.
Right.
And then, as you mentioned, the Sharif of Hussein, they took his sons and made them kings of Jordan, which I guess her name was Gertrude B., was it, or was active with Winston Churchill and Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, there's a lot of interesting stuff. We have to have one on that issue, Ed. I mean, that deserves 2 hours in itself.
Yes, but yeah, the average person. But your contention of what we're trying to learn from all this, the most important thing for our audience is, because we're concluding the peace treaty of Sèvres. The peace treaty of Sèvres was a part of the peace treaty of Versailles. It's not so distinctly different. The major issues were resolved in Versailles. They just went to another suburb of Paris and decided how to deal with the Turks separately.
Right.
And they decided how to deal with the Armenians, the Kurds, the Circassians, and God knows how.
I think the Kurds were mentioned. You asked me.
I mean Sèvres. I mean, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, if they had been mentioned, I think I would remember. So I don't think they were mentioned.
For some strange reason, I think the Kurds were mentioned in Sèvres because
maybe.
After all, they are a giant population.
But that doesn't mean anything when it comes to international relations.
Yeah. So,
look at the document.
Right.
What it says.
Yeah. So, in any event, it was not signed by anyone. So, therefore, why is it so important? It's not
you
important.
You think it's important. I want to talk about Lausanne.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. I just want to conclude the half hour of which we're concluding, and I want to do another station identification in reminding our listeners that we're listening to Professor Dennis R. Papazian, a professor of history, spent most of his life here in Michigan at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and now retired in New Jersey, of which whom we are speaking with. This program is pre-recorded. You cannot call in, but you can listen to us on our podcast, which is WHFR.FM on the internet, and look for the item called Forum. That's this program, which is a part of. And when you click on Forum, you will see a date, and it will be the date of March 27th. And when you do that, you'll come upon Then and Now. And I am your host today, Ned Apigian, on Then and Now, and I've introduced Professor Papazian to you. And our subject matter on Then and Now, on our monthly programming, is how history, the events of history, affect our current events, which will be the final quarter of the program. We're going to devote the next quarter or so primarily on the Peace Treaty of Lausanne, its promises, its failures, and how it in its successes, wherever Dr. Papazian will take us. So we're pleased that you're taking the time to listen to us, and we are here in Michigan, in Dearborn, Michigan, at the Henry Ford Community College, making waves at 89.3 FM. Now, our next 15 minutes or so will be devoted to Dr. Papazian explaining what it was that the Peace Treaty of Lausanne gave to the state of Turkey, its establishment, what promises, if any, were made to the other minorities who thought they had promises made to them in the Peace Treaty of Sevres. And Dr. Papazian, the forum is yours.
Thank you, Ned. The fact of the matter is people want to talk about Sevres, which is a failed treaty because it deals with a lot of interesting issues, such as granting independence to Armenia. So people want to talk about that. The fact of the matter, it was a failed treaty. It's up in the sky someplace. It has no meaning today. The real treaty is the Treaty of Lausanne. So we have to confront reality, what really happened. What really happened was that Kemal Atatürk established a powerful government in Anatolia, and he dictated terms to the Allies through his close companion, İsmet Paşa İnönü. İsmet Paşa goes to Lausanne, and he says, forget all of this talk about dividing Turkey, the heartland of Turkey. The Ottoman Empire, okay, that's gone. We want to deal with Turkey itself. We don't want any Armenians to worry about. We don't want any Kurds to worry about. We don't want any Greeks to worry about. We don't want to worry about anyone. We want this area for us Turks. Now, the Allies had a little bit of a guilty conscience because, after all, they had made all of these promises to all these minorities, particularly to the Armenians, and now they are confronted with the situation where they have no power whatsoever to do anything for the Armenians in terms of being a nationality.
Or anybody else.
Or anybody else. But there's no one else left in Anatolia.
Well.
Okay? The others are settled. Okay? So we have Anatolia now. The only claim of Anatolia, real claim, was that of the Armenians through a whole bunch of things, which I don't want to go into at the
moment. How about the Georgians and the Azeris? Did they
have
the
any... Georgians and the Azeris, Azerbaijan was never occupied by the Turks. They did go send armies into Azerbaijan.
But it was always part of Tsarist Russia, is that the point?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was part of
Tsarist or Russia. Iran.
And Iran wasn't involved in this either. That's already with the other treaties. Now, let's get to Lausanne. The fact I want to establish is that the current Turkish state was established at Lausanne. It became a legal state at Lausanne. It is a foundation treaty of the Republic of Turkey, and that has to be stressed very, very much because it is still in effect.
Okay? So it's the foundation state of the Turkish Republic, and its date is August 1922?
July 24th, 1923.
Oh, July 24th, 1923.
Right. You keep wanting to go back to 22, but it's 23.
Okay, what's the...
All right, now, listen to this. It says, these articles are fundamental laws of Turkey, and that no law, no regulation, no official action shall conflict or interfere with these stipulations, nor shall any law, regulation, nor official action prevail over them. This is a treaty thing. Okay? Then at the end of the articles, it says further that any changes have to be approved of by Great Britain, France, and it wasn't Italy, I don't think, in this case. Anyway, the signatories of the treaty. So now...
Well, it wasn't the United States.
No,
they
no,
weren't
no.
part
the
of
United
the treaty.
States had never declared war on Turkey.
Turkey.
Okay, now... Since the Turkish government promises to do certain things, there
like
are stipulations
what?
Of how to enforce these.
What did they promise to do?
Well, that, if you let me get to it, let me first give the enforcement, then I'll get back to all these stipulations, which are tremendous and mind-boggling, okay? So first, any changes have to be approved by the signatory powers, and any complaints about the administration of the treaty should go to the Council of the League of Nations.
Right.
And then the League of Nations should give it to the International Court of Justice for adjudication, et cetera, et cetera. The whole system of that.
And as we found out from the recent seminar at the University of Michigan, if you don't begin your complaint in the Turkish state, you don't go to the International Court of Justice.
Right. Now, this is the problem because there are many... transgressions of this treaty, particularly against the major minorities protected are the Greeks, the Armenians, and the Jews. Their rights have been trampled upon. They have complained to the Turkish government. They have gone to the law courts. The law courts have denied them redress. And when the law courts were informed that they had acted against the treaty, they changed the wording, but did not change the judgment.
That's interesting.
Very clever. Now, what was at stake here? It was a question of minority properties, whether or not minorities can own properties such as hospitals, schools, churches, cemeteries, and the like, okay? Now, according to Turkish law, the citizens of Turkey can have these things. According to the Treaty of Versailles, the minority, the protected minorities, which are only three, the Kurds, the Armenians, and the Jews, no, the
Greeks.
The Greeks, Armenians, and Jews are considered, when it comes to the law courts, as foreigners. Now, how can citizens of Turkey, when it comes to the application of Turkish law, be considered as foreigners? And as foreigners, they don't have the rights of the Treaty of Lausanne. But as citizens, they do have the rights of the treaties of Lausanne.
How about the Kurds? They disappear.
The Kurds
they're
are
mountain
not in
Turks.
This treaty. The Kurds are left out of the treaty.
So they're treated as them. They're referred to as mountain Kurds, Turks, and left
mountain
at
Turks,
that.
Mountain Turks, etc. See, the negotiators, the Turkish negotiators at Lausanne, knew exactly what they were doing. They
Dennis, let me interrupt you for a moment because you need to remember this. The big problem in Turkey today is they're having a civil war within their country with the Kurds. That's the reason why I'm bringing this up, because in the latter 10 minutes of the program, it's the problems we see today are a result of not being recognized in Lausanne, being recognized in Sèvres. That's why I'm taking you there. I wanted to bring that
up.
Sure.
Well, the fact of the matter is the Kurdish question was not settled by either treaty. The Kurds were roundly ignored, and the Turks, as you said, consider them as mountain Turks, refuse to accept them as a nationality, okay? So now the Treaty of Lausanne gives these rights to the Christians, Jews, and That's it, the Greeks, Armenians, and Jews. Okay, now, you're talking about the other minorities, what I call the heterodox Muslims.
The Circassians.
The Alevis, others, minorities.
You call
all
them what?
These, huh?
You call them what?
Heterodox. In other words, they're not Orthodox. They're not Sunni Turks.
But the Kurds are Sunni Muslims.
Yeah, they're Sunni Muslims, but the Kurds, I mean, the Turks see there's a difference. The Alevis are different. There were several other groups that have disappeared from sight. So we have the Turks claiming that Alevis, et cetera, do not exist. There's only one group out there that are Muslim, and all Muslims are Muslims. That's it. Now, the reason for this claim, if you want to talk about that, is because in the Ottoman Empire, there was no distinction made amongst or between Muslims.
Yes.
Okay? So the Turks are saying, you're part of the ruling elite, you're part of the Millet Hakimeh, you don't need any special rights, you're one of us, okay? So now, the Kurds, if you want to get into the Kurdish question, which is something different, because it's not under Lausanne, the Kurds are saying, hey, we're a nation, we are people, we have a language. Now, interestingly enough, is that under Lausanne, there are certain rights reserved for other minorities other than the three named minorities. In fact, they weren't named by name, but they were named by category, okay? The word Armenian is not in the treaty whatsoever. So now they are trying to minimize, the Turks are, the rights and privileges of minorities, but the Allies insist on certain rights and privileges being granted to all minorities, which now is going to include the Kurds and others, such as a right to use their language in public, such as a right to have schools, such as a right freely to immigrate and emigrate, to come and to go, such as a right to have their own facilities, et cetera, which are rights given to all Turkish nationals, not just minorities, but all Turkish nationals, and indirectly, of course, then to the minorities. And these rights and privilege, I don't call them privileges, they're rights. These rights are denied all of the minorities, including the non-technical minorities of Lausanne, namely the Kurds, the Alevis, and others, Nakhichevan, and others in Turkey. So if you go to Turkey today, you will find a lot of unhappy people, other than Turks themselves, people we and you and I don't even hear about, but they recognize themselves as being different and want to be different. They enjoy being different. Just like here in the United States, everybody can be different. We all have a good time. They want to do that in Turkey. They want Turkey to be a multinational state, more or less like the Ottoman Empire was a multinational state. The chief difference being that all citizens should have equality before the law, which was not true of the old Ottoman Empire.
So the Turks violated what major part? The only thing they guaranteed was the founding document to establish the Turkish state in Anatolia.
Let me just give you a couple of the articles, okay? This explains it all. Okay. These people, all inhabitants of Turkey, are assured full and complete protection of life, liberty, without distinction of birth, nationality, language, race, or religion. All inhabitants of Turkey shall be entitled to free exercise, whether in public or private, of any creed, religion, or belief. Now, those are pretty broad rights. They're given in the treaty. They are ignored. Now, let me give you some more here. Article 39, all Turkish nationals belonging to non-Muslim minorities will enjoy the same civil and political rights as Muslims. All the inhabitants of Turkey, without distinction of religion, shall be equal before the law. But you can't say that these minorities are not real Turks. They are real Turks. Differences of religion, creed, or confession shall not prejudice any Turkish national in matters relating to an enjoyment of civil or political rights, as, for instance, admission to public employment, functions and honors, or the exercise of professions and industries. Well, you know as well as I do, there are no minorities hardly in the civil service. There are none in the security services. They don't rise to any rank in the army. They're not active in the government. So this stipulation of Lausanne is ignored.
There were more of that under the Ottoman rule of the sultans.
Exactly, exactly. Many Armenians rose to high places.
Prime ministers.
And... Yeah, yeah.
Now, it is, unfortunately, this is so interesting and our time is going by so fast. I would like you to concentrate on some of the problems of today after I give a very brief station identification, because the point of the program is to give this interesting background, which you cannot get everywhere, it's certainly not commonly known. But the important thing is, because of this, this is what's going on today in the issues of today. If you can think about that before I say, we are listening to Professor Dennis R. Papazian, professor of history, retired from the University of Michigan, Dearborn, now residing in New Jersey, talking to us over the telephone. I am Ned Apigian, your host on Then and Now, a program devoted to how history affects current events, and we are broadcasting from the Henry Ford Community College radio station WHFR 89.3 FM on your dial, and you can find this program on the internet if you search for WHFR.FM. And here we are today in this pre-recorded program, so you cannot call us. And Dr. Papazian, can you concentrate our last 10 minutes or so on what is happening in current events because of these either rejected Treaty of Sèvres or what was proposed in Lausanne? And I would like to begin by telling you, I attended a meeting seminar of which the Turkish state was carrying around this Jewish individual who was prominent in the Jewish community of Istanbul. And one of the interesting things he said was, based on the guarantees of the peace treaty of Lausanne, we Jews are guaranteed this, this, and that. I found that very interesting in his presentation.
Well, it's absolutely true.
Yes.
But the same guarantees are for Greeks and Armenians. And they're,
yes,
they're abused just as the Jews are. So there's no difference. Now,
so what's happening to the Armenians of Turkey because of this abuse? You might want to spend a couple minutes on that.
I want to go back to
okay,
the Kurds, if, with your permission.
Please, absolutely.
Okay. I want to read an article. No restriction will be imposed on the free use of any Turkish national of any language in private intercourse, in commerce, religion, and the press, or in publications of any kind, or at any public meeting. Now, this has been roundly denied to the Kurds, which is one reason they're rebelling today. So my contention is the treaty has been ignored. It has not been enforced by those who signed it. And accordingly, there are multiple problems which existed in those days continue to exist. And Turkey is a state which is not stable. You have different factions struggling amongst themselves. You have the old Ataturk elites who are representing the army and the
foreign service,
the foreign service and the security services. Then you have the new government, which is slightly Islamic,
very Islamic next to previous governments.
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so, personally. I mean, I think we can have a difference of opinion here, an honest and respectable difference.
Well, it happens to be the name of their party is the only reason why.
What
is
the AK Party? It's not called an Islamic party. That Islamic party was outlawed. Many of the members of that party are in this party, but it is not technically an Islamic party. They really haven't passed anything that is injurious to the secularism of the state, except that women aren't supposed to, you know, they passed a law that women wear hair scarves in college. Well, I don't consider that terribly Islamic. I mean, a lot of Christian women wear head scarves in college. So, you know, I think this is all just fuzz in the air. It's dust blown in our faces. The fact of the matter is the treaty is roundly ignored. Those who signed it don't enforce it. Therefore, all of these minorities are in turmoil, and the Kurds in particular. And there's a three-way struggle going on between the present government, which is trying to accommodate the Kurds, but the old establishment won't let them. And so Turkey is trying to reform itself. It wants into the European Union. But you have all of this baggage from the past, and these people are in the military, they're in the bureaucracy, they're in the Secret Service, and they go around killing people. The Ergenon group is all made up of these people. They go around assassinating people.
Is this reference to the deep government in Turkey?
The deep state, as they call it, yes.
The deep state.
So, the problems of today are directly related to no one enforcing the treaty, which is the foundation treaty of the Turkish state.
Well, they pretty well, there aren't many Greeks left in Turkey, and there certainly aren't many Armenians.
Because they were driven out with the tax of 1942, the so-called wealth tax, which was imposed on Greeks, Armenians, and Jews only.
Is this the Varlik Versi tax?
Yes.
I thought it was 1940. You said 42?
About 40 then.
Oh, you're the expert. So is that what that was called?
I think it was 56 when you had the Kristallnacht of the Greeks, where they went through the Greek quarters to
their
homes, their businesses, and everything.
I thought it was September 55.
But you got it.
The real issue is that the deep state affects Armenians. You didn't say much. That is a problem because of the recent assassination of Mr. Hrant Dink in their attempt to have some reformation in the Turkish society.
Well, as I was reading the articles of the treaty, which guarantee the Armenians certain rights, mm-hmm. which have been ignored, we didn't go through all of those rights.
Repair of the schools and hospitals and facilities, I understand there's problems with that.
Right, the freedom to teach their language, to speak it in public.
And then they made Turkish principles of Armenian schools and things like
that.
Right,
and the Armenian language is limited to so many hours per week. The church is not able to paint the outside of the patriarchate. Properties were turned when lost when the bridge was built. Greek cemeteries have been taken over for high rises. There's a whole bunch of these things, and nobody enforces the Treaty of Lausanne. So everybody talks about Sevres, because that was the glorious treaty,
mm-hmm.
and they don't talk about what they have in their hand today.
So what's your point, your important thing is those Armenian nationals that want to condemn or crucify or justify or say the Treaty of Sevres gives us everything we're entitled to was not signed by anyone, and the Peace Treaty of Lausanne does give us some ammunition which we are not using. Is that the point?
Exactly.
Now, I am going to let you, we have about 2.5 to 3/4 minutes left for you to summarize whatever you'd like to summarize before we conclude the program at your discretion. So how would you like to tell us about these World War I issues that were not satisfied?
Like you said, Nettie, the issues of World War I still exist in part today. The issues of World War I did not settle the complicated pattern either in the Middle East nor in Europe. It did not settle the problem between Germany and France, and so we get into World War II. World War II was a horrific war once more, but this time people were a little more intelligent, and so what they did, rather than trying to punish those that they defeated, they tried to raise them up and make allies of them, as the Romans had done thousands of years ago. In other words, if people had read Greek and Roman history, they would have known how to do these things, but they didn't. So after World War II, things turned out a little better. But still, there are the treaties of World War I, which should be enforced, namely the Treaty of Lausanne. The treaty gives certain rights to minorities in Turkey. These rights are ignored and abused. If the people who were responsible for the Treaty of Lausanne insisted on affecting its articles,
mm-hmm.
that these articles be followed, you wouldn't have the problems in Turkey that you have today. And so it's a very direct relationship. And Turkey is trying to solve these problems. Many Turks, you have liberal Turks, you have reforming Turks, you have conservative Turks. It's a complex society. But there have been major efforts, doing the effort to join the European Union,
right?
The so-called reconciliation packages or something like that were passed to try to reconcile Turkish law with European law so that the Turkish state would be acceptable to the European community.
Well, Dennis, in the last 30 seconds of the program, I'd like to thank you very much for participating in this program. And we hope our listening audience has certainly been informed. Some of the time I say informed and entertained. We try to do both, but mostly informed, not by me, but by our guests. There's one other thing I'd like to say is to our listening audience, make sure you turn me in again. And that's the fourth Saturday of every month. And now to our closing. Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome, Ned.
Have been listening to Then and Now, a pre-recorded program brought to you from 10 to 11 a.m. on the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of our talk show format entitled the WHFR Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events by your host, Ned Apigian, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear this program on the World Wide Web at www.whfr.fm. Thank you.
Chaos all around me, with its fever clinging, but I can hear you singing in the cold.